Welcome to today's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, your host, and thank you so much for joining us. Today we have Jeff Brown. He is a podcaster, mentor, and speaker. He has shared his insights with people around the world on leadership, professional development, productivity, entrepreneurship, and many more things. He actually is a 26-year veteran in the radio industry, even co-hosted an award-winning, nationally syndicated morning show from 2002 to 2008. Jeff is the podcaster of the very successful podcast, Read to Lead. You should check it out. He has interviewed so many amazing authors, dove into the book ideas, broken them down. You can hear firsthand from those authors what they were thinking, and kind of like Cliff Note, but with the actual author explaining it, taking you through their book and the journey. Jeff was also a consultant. He talks to people about how to create a podcast. He helped me early on, and he's just a really great guy. If you want to check him out, you can find out more about Jeff on readtoleadpodcast.com. All of the notes will be on our page as well. And he's recently launching a new Read to Lead group membership where they read books and they meet to talk about the books and set goals to actually do what the books suggest, not just read them, which is super cool. ReadToLeadUniversity.com. You can check that out as well. Again, all those links will be on our page. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you liked today's show. Welcome to this week's episode. Hey, we have Jeff here. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
I am great, Laura. I am so excited to be here, and I really appreciate you inviting me on. I'm looking forward to this.
I am too, and I'm just going to come clean out of the gate.
Okay.
Jeff was my first sort of touch point in the podcast world. I was a client of his. Jeff, along with a bunch of other things that we'll chat about, is somebody who consults and helps people get their podcasts off the ground. So just a big thank you to you for helping me, you know, see the forest through the trees of getting this podcast launched. So I appreciate it.
Well, let me say, you are somebody who has a lot of natural talent in this space, and I don't feel like I can take credit for the podcast you've put together. You're doing a great job, and I feel like a lot of that has to do with you, and very little of it has to do with me.
Thank you. Very, very generous. But, well, you know, if anybody out there is thinking about a podcast, there are about 150 tiny details to getting this launched. I would definitely recommend hitting up Jeffy. He will make it much less painful. But all that aside, Jeff, you know, we talked, we worked together. I obviously know of your podcast, Read to Lead, but your backstory, the way you sort of landed in the podcast world, you started in radio and you were there for 26 years. Not to overly exaggerate the amount of years.
I'm an old man.
I heard how I said that. But I guess I'm really excited to, if you could talk a little bit about your experience in radio and how you really see the radio world and the podcast world. They're sort of similar, but, you know, obviously different. But tell us a little bit about your background in radio and then how you sort of moved towards the podcast world.
Yeah, I kind of fell into it in a way. I had gone to school to be a music teacher and had a semester of student teaching at the junior high level and was kind of scared out of doing that for the rest of my life after spending some time with some junior high students. And so I ended up dropping out of school. I was midway through my junior year, if you can believe that. And because I wasn't really sure of what I wanted to do at this point, I decided to just drop out. I'm one of those who probably should have taken some time off between high school and college, and I didn't do that. Mm-hmm. Just kind of went right into doing the thing that everybody kind of said I was good at. And I went, okay, I'll do that. I even had some high school guidance counselors see that I had wanted to take some radio courses in high school. My high school had a radio station, and they talked me out of that because that's not what I was going to do supposedly for a career. So I didn't need to take those courses. And I spent about 3 years kind of searching. And during that time, just sort of kind of fell into a program, kind of a crash course in, you know, what you need to know to get your first radio job. And 6 months later, I found myself in my first radio job, literally, and just kind of learned as I went, making mistakes as I went along. In fact, I look back on it, and I think I was fired from every radio job I've ever had, except maybe one.
What do you mean? Like, why were you fired? Were you one of those, you know, needs to be your own boss kind of guys? Like, what were the reasons for that?
Well, some of it is the nature of the industry, and some of it's, you know, it can be a very, what have you done for me lately? It's very, you know, ratings driven, that sort of thing. You know, my first job, I was fired from 9 months in just because I was an idiot. I thought it was God's gift to radio. I think in a lot of ways, I was 21, 22 years old and thought that the people turned their radios on because I was on the air. You know, I mean, that was kind of my attitude. And I mean, it sounds ridiculous now, but that's kind of how I looked at the world. And it took those in charge at that particular station kind of yanking the rug out from under my feet and saying, well, you know, not so fast, mister. Mm-hmm. You don't work here anymore, to kind of get me to wake up and figure out what, you know, what this really was all about. And so I kind of eased into my next radio job with quite a bit of humility that I hadn't really had much of until that point, and realized that, you know, I still have a lot to learn. And so that next job was the one I stayed at for 8 years. And when I left, it was on my own accord. Mm. And, you know, went to a couple of different places, a couple of different radio stations, mostly either Indianapolis or Nashville. I ended up moving to Nashville to work in the music business. I left radio for a brief period of time, and I did that for a few years, and then went back to radio. The last place I was at, I was there for 14 years and loved it, learned a lot, had some great experiences. But even that one eventually ended because the station began to make changes. Mm-hmm. Guy who hired me left, you know, and people started getting replaced kind of one at a time. And I was one of those people. In fact, three of us on the same day, as I recall. But, you know, that's just kind of, again, that's the nature of the industry. But I've had some wonderful experiences doing that, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
And let's just be honest, maybe that arrogance early on was because you have to have been told this 100 times. You do have like the smoothest, coolest radio voice ever.
Well, it's funny. If we could hear, I wish I still had them. I think my mom had them at one point. But if we could still hear cassette tapes of me in my first week on the air, we would both have a really good laugh because I just sounded ridiculous. I guess over time, your voice, both literally and figuratively, kind of develops. And I think mine has done that over time, just from, it's an instrument, you know, I've used it so much, and sort of the 10,000 hour rule, the more you practice, you know, the better it gets. And I don't think I always sounded like I sound now, but just over time, it kind of becomes what it is.
Like for everybody listening, I swear to God, right? It's like, you can just hear you on like smooth jazz. It's like the perfect. So those are reasonable reasons to leave, though. I mean, those are, you know, 8 years, 14 years, you know, long, long periods of time in those positions, learning a lot. What do you feel like you really learned in the radio industry that you could bring over to the podcast world? And what do you see as the big difference in podcasting versus radio?
Yeah, virtually everything I do as a podcaster, I learned as a broadcaster. I have taken every experience from my time in radio and applied it to podcasting, from how to market myself to how to really connect with an audience and what that really means, how to leverage the intimacy of the medium, I like to call it. Because creating content in these spaces, in the audio space, I think is so different than so many other ways you could create content. There certainly are some similarities, but there are things that you can do that really draw an audience in, and you can really have a lot of fun with that. And so everything I've done in radio informs how I act as a podcaster, how I conduct what I do. As far as the differences go, I think really there's only one that sticks out to me. And that is that radio traditionally is a medium that's thought of as live. And, you know, when you turn the radio on, you as a listener don't dictate what comes next. The station does. Hopefully that's what you want to hear, but sometimes it isn't. In the podcasting space, it's audio on demand predominantly, right? So as a listener, I'm picking and choosing what I want to hear and when I want to hear it. And so, like everything else in our world these days, it's very, you know, customizable. And so one is typically live, the other typically isn't. But everything else, for the most part, Laura, in my view anyway, is very, very much the same.
So when you say like connecting to the audience, leveraging the interaction, is there like a trade, like number one way that you can connect to an audience? Like, what does that mean? What kinds of things do audiences over radio connect to versus obviously visually with a television? There's the, you know, the stimulation of the screen. What do you feel like is the golden rule? Is there one?
Well, one of the things is something you did earlier, and I think it's because you had such an awesome podcast coach, but you very subtly referred to me at one point in the third person. And when you did that, you were talking directly to your listener without doing things like, announcing that I'm going to talk to the listener now. You didn't do that. You just referred to me very subtly in the third person. And everybody listening in that moment felt as if you were talking just to them. I think it's important to leverage second person you and your when you want to pull the listener into the conversation. And again, not announce that, okay, we're going to go talk to listeners now, and then we'll come back and we'll talk to Jeff some more. These are subtle things. Maybe we're splitting hairs. You could argue that. But when you leverage these techniques, I think it's truly powerful from the listener standpoint, because much like when you give a public talk, I mean, obviously you're speaking to a room full of people. Much like you hope your podcast is listened to by at least a room full of people, if not a few more. But when you speak to that room full of people, if you're doing your job well, you're trying to make connections, you know, one person at a time, individual connections with everybody in the room. This medium is a one-to-many medium, but if you do it well, everybody walks away from this conversation having felt like they participated in it rather than being relegated to feel like they were just an eavesdropper on a conversation you and I had a week ago.
Right, right. So Jeff was just telling us, is that...
There you go.
That he's in the podcast world, and the podcast is called Read to Lead. This podcast is so specifically organized around writers and books that you feel you want to interview and talk to. Why this topic? Why Read to Lead? And as a follow-up question, it's not just read to something, right? You picked Read to Lead. How come?
Yeah, a couple of reasons. I have seen the power and the role that intentional and consistent reading have played in my life, in large part because a leader at one of those radio stations I worked at was the kind of leader who understood the value of bringing books into the workplace. He understood the value of books and the fact that we should be doing more of this, and we should be doing it together, and we should be talking about what we're learning and then talking about next actions and how to implement what we're learning. When I came into contact with that individual at the station I was at the time, it was that one that I was at for a really long time, for 14 years. And this was back in about 2003. So I'm in my early 30s. And I'd spent the previous 10 years sort of with the attitude of, you know, coming out of school and going, gosh, I'm glad that's over. I don't have to learn anymore. I don't have to read anymore. I'm not having to write anymore. All these things I had to do in school, school taught me not to enjoy those things, honestly. Mm-hmm. And so,
mm-hmm. Right. Because it's like read, you know, some great work in one week. With a ton of other work going on, and then spit out some, you know, essay to get graded on, right? It's just
exactly, not fun. Exactly. Yeah. Not fun at all. And I was sort of really for the first time, as embarrassing as this is to admit, in my early 30s, really for the first time, had my world opened up with a lot of business books that I wasn't paying attention to. Now, in my early 20s, I had explored Zig Ziglar and Og Mandino and some others, but I think I was too young, and we've established my maturity level, too immature to appreciate at that time. And so at this time in my life, now, you know, fast forward 10 years, and suddenly they hit me in a different way. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't get enough of this. And so I just became this voracious reader and have continued to be now here 15 or so years removed from that, still am. And when I was kicking around the idea for a podcast, it's something that I had wanted to do for several years and just hadn't landed on what I was going to do one about. And I was just on my way home from work one day and listening to an audiobook, and I was counting up the number of books I had read at that point in time. And it was like a book a week. I was 3 months into the year and I'd read almost 12 books. And I was like, gosh, I had no idea I was reading at that pace. Wow, that a book a week. I thought a book a month would be great.
Right, and so right.
When I said that, I'm literally in the car and I said that to myself out loud, like, wow, that's a book a week. When I said that to myself, sort of a light bulb went off, and I thought, you know, because I thought of podcasts as sort of weekly, you know, things, even though they're not all weekly. That's kind of how I had categorized them. And so when I said that, that spoke podcast to me. I thought, there's the idea for a podcast I've been looking for. That's what I do a podcast about. How cool would it be to interview some of these folks, to talk about the books they're writing, and also to share this process with other people who were like me, who either don't enjoy reading or think they don't, or know they should be reading more and can't quite find the time to do as much as they want. Maybe I could kind of give them an audio cliff notes, the main insights, key insights, main ideas of the books that I'm reading, and have it come, you know, straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So
yeah, because the book itself is interesting, but to kind of hear the author, one of my favorite things about podcasts is you can literally find almost any author out there now. And hearing what they were really thinking as they were writing the books. And, you know, it's different. It's a different sort of avenue in. So, okay, I have to ask then, who helped you get your podcast live? Was that something that you got a coach with, or is that, did you just scrape your way through it?
Well, you know, I had a lot of experiences that lent themselves, obviously, to doing a podcast, but there were still some aspects of the process that I was not at all familiar with. And so I looked, okay, what equipment do I need? I had been in radio for all these years, but I didn't have equipment at home that I could leverage. But what do I need to pull off a podcast? And so I looked at folks like Cliff Ravenscraft, who had, you know, a little equipment package, you know, basically podcaster in a box you could order. And so I ordered that, and I found some videos on YouTube that kind of walked you through, you know, setting up an RSS feed and that sort of a few of the things that I didn't quite understand or have my head wrapped around. And so, you know, I started planning in March. In April, I think it was, I bought my equipment. In May, I started lining up guests, did that through May and June. And in July of that year, 2013, I launched. And so I've just very methodically went through the process one step at a time until I felt like I had enough, you know, episodes or interviews under my belt that I was good to go.
And how do you determine, like, so it's read to lead, not lead to grow read to grow a garden, or like, you know what I mean? It's specifically like around leadership. Do you look for authors who are, or is it just personally lead for yourself? But how do you decide on your authors and books?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I spend a lot of time reading books that I think are going to result in my inviting that author on. And then I never end up inviting them on because maybe the book or the content didn't quite grab me. Mm-hmm. And so that means some research that never sees the light of day, if you will. I think it's important as podcasters, as hosts, especially when we're doing interviews, that we vet our guests, that we demonstrate. You obviously haven't done that today, but that you demonstrate.
Sorry, demonstrate. Everybody. I just slipped on this one.
Oh, my. Will this interview ever see the light of day? We'll see. No, but I think it's important that you demonstrate in a number of ways that you respect your listeners' time, and embedding your guests is obviously a great way to do that. But for me, it's not just about leadership. I think there are a lot of different kinds of books we can read that all lend themselves to making us better leaders. So that would include, you know, books on personal growth, books on career and jobs, books on marketing, books on sales, books on entrepreneurship. I think books about all those topics make us, at the end of the day, better leaders, not just books specifically about leadership. So as I'm reading books, as I stumble across books, as I find books that fascinate and excite me, I will begin to reach out to the authors of those books, or, you know, people in their sphere, and see if they're interested in coming on the show. Now, at this point in my journey, I'm almost 4 years into it now. You know, I get a lot of requests coming in from people who want to be on the show. And so I'm doing a lot less sort of the manual side of it, a lot less going out myself and finding people, and really more having to vet the requests that are coming in.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. I mean, you have one of the top podcasts out there. And so after all of this time speaking to these authors 4 years in reading these books, do you have any thoughts on something you could share with us on, is there a theme to what makes somebody lead in a way that's effective? Is there something you've picked up from hearing this many people on these different topics?
Yeah, a couple of things come to mind, Laura. One of my favorite books from the last several years is written by an author named Liz Weissman. She co-wrote it with Greg McKeown, who went on to write Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. And the book that she, and Liz and Greg wrote together is called Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter. And this leader I hinted at a moment ago, who got me excited about books again, he was very good at this. I've worked for leaders and frankly been the kind of leader who, when there was a star on the team, felt threatened by that. And you know, I approached leadership early in my career as, well, I'm the leader, so I'm the one who's supposed to know how to do everything. Your job is to just do what I tell you to do. And that's still rampant in a lot of companies.
Yeah.
But I appreciated this former leader of mine who taught me this. His name is, I started to say was, he still is. His name is Matt Austin. He's at a station in Dallas now. He used to be in Nashville, Tennessee, but he's in Dallas, Texas now, doing a great job at a station there. And he understood how to leverage the collective brain power in the room. And it's sort of a paradox. The more he would deflect credit onto other people and spread the credit around for wins, the better he became viewed as a leader. And so if you can be sure to just give credit where it's due, that ends up coming back around to bless you at the same time.
Yeah. I can't stress that enough. I owned a company and ran it for many years, and I was only 24 when I started. And truth be told, I was totally not equipped for this job. I was a philosophy undergrad and graduate student. I thought I was going a different direction, and I ended up in entrepreneurship. And I had to learn that lesson. I hired somebody with 10 years more experience than me, out of the gate. And I just felt so threatened. I was like, oh my God, he's going to find out. I have no idea what I'm doing. But I think the more you just promote them and tell them how great they are, the more charitable they are, even if you are actually more junior to the person you're managing, right? Because that can happen.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally.
So outside of the books that have come on, the books that are current, but even books of the past, do you have a favorite book?
Yeah, for me, it's kind of like having to pick your favorite kid. But
I was going to say, I feel like this question, or do you have a couple that you could share?
Yeah, and one would be Multipliers. It's one of my probably top five, if not the number one spot in the last few years. I think that book came out in 2010, I believe. Now that I think about it, I was thinking 2013, but I guess it's older than that. Another favorite from last year is a book called Living Forward. It's a book by Michael Hyatt and Daniel Harkavy. And the simplest way to explain this book, and this is going to sound probably super simplified, but it's funny, most people don't do this. We all know how a budget works. And the idea behind a budget when it comes to our money is you spend the money on paper first. You tell your money where to go instead of getting to the end of the month and wondering where it went, right? And this book, Living Forward, is very much about living life that way. It's living your life on paper. It's sitting down and planning out the kind of life you want to have so that you don't get to the end of life and go, gee, that didn't turn out the way I'd hoped.
Right.
The biggest regret most people have in the studies that I have seen is getting to the end of their lives and regretting the things they didn't do, regretting the things they wish they would have done.
Yep.
And this book,
bucket list idea.
Yeah. And this book walks you through how to make sure that doesn't happen to you. And so that's one that I would highly recommend.
What a great idea, because I think everybody listening, and myself included, right? We get it. I mean, the bucket list, and we're aware of the things we want. But I think the biggest question people have is how? How do I make it happen? I have so many competing stresses and pulls on my time and financial constraints, right? So how? So that this book brings up is it like a walkthrough of how to get this accomplished?
Yeah, and it's very much so. Walks you through step by step. And the idea is that you take a day all to yourself, and basically you create, and it walks you through how to create a life plan. And ideally, if you're married, for example, you would come together with your partner after the two of you have done your own life plan, and then you would marry the two life plans into one and figure out what that's going to look like. And it's more than about a bucket list. It's really about being intentional about the life you live, such that you all but guarantee that your life involves leaving a legacy at the end of the day.
So interesting. So obviously this podcast is about authenticity, success, and purpose, and how to navigate all of it. And you've chosen a book that's really bringing up that theme as one of your absolute favorites. So how do you define what an authentic life means?
Well, I have been fortunate the last several years, especially, to be afforded the opportunity to do only the things I want to do, with a few exceptions. Obviously, we all have to occasionally do things we don't want to do. But I have never felt more authentic in the life that I live than I do right now. I never saw myself 10 years ago as being the kind of person who would work for themselves. I thought I could never do that. But through the reading that I've done, primarily the books that I've read, I had to figure out that that's exactly the kind of life that I personally need to be living, because it's where I feel most at home. It's where I feel most authentic. Mm. And so for me, I define authenticity as being able to say no to the things that I don't want to do, the things that aren't authentic to me. And I'm thankful to have that kind of life now, where if it doesn't resonate, if it doesn't feel right, if it's something that I don't think is part of that life plan, then I can say no and feel good about that. I used to struggle with saying no. I used to feel like I had to take on everything and keep everybody happy. I went to college, I mentioned the first time around, as a music ed major. I had some talents there, but that's not what I wanted to do. But I did it because I felt like that's what I was supposed to do. I had to meet certain expectations. And to me, life now is about meeting my own expectations first. And then if there's time, I can get to some of those others. But that sounds selfish, but it's not. It's sort of, this is probably an overused analogy, but you know, on the airplane, they tell you, you know, put your own mask on first and make sure you're you're good to go before you try to worry about anybody else. And that's ultimately what I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, Jeff, I love how you just expressed that, because you brought up something that I think many people struggle with is, you know, you brought up the story at the beginning where you left school, you know, not knowing what to do. People are telling you what your talents are. So you're like, okay, I'll just go ahead and try that or try this. And it's an interesting dilemma, because we find ourselves in a world where it's so many choices, so much abundance, you know, relative to history. Mm. And how do you make those choices? And your point about it being selfish, right, is something that I feel comes up time and time again with my clients and the people I speak to about this topic. If I start with myself, if I ask myself what I really want and I try to do the things that make me happy, what does that say about me? It can't be like that. I have to do things. I should do things. I have obligations to things, right? And it's like we have this very strange narrative about how to live our life, kind of then resulting in the book topic you mentioned, that we sort of end of life looking back saying, how did I end up spending my time that way? So
exactly,
you know, there's a difference between building a life that has meaning for you and selfishness, right?
Yeah, totally.
it's funny that we feel like there's like one little jump from a purpose-based life to selfishness. It doesn't mean you have to be a selfish person. You can still be considerate of others. And
certainly, I like to think that I am. My wife struggles with, you know, being a people pleaser as well, and she's, I'm not speaking out of turn here, she's admitted this, when she's at her most unhappiest when she's trying to do that, and then she's not equipped to serve anybody, you know. And so it's got to start with you, and then I think you're better equipped to impact others.
Well, people pleasing is hysterical, because it's like this collective they that we try to please.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, like when is it over? When have you pleased enough people? there's millions of people. Every day you bump into, you have to please them all. And how do you even know? I mean, you're not like surveying to see how you're doing.
Right.
You know, how did the Whole Foods checkout person feel in the Starbucks, right? Like, it's exhausting. So, and you shared your story about your journey towards having this life. But do you have tips, practical things that you do on a day-to-day basis to help navigate this life that you now find, you know, fits so well for you, so that you don't make inauthentic decisions?
Yeah, I'm still working on it. But one of the things I do, and this comes from the Living Forward philosophy, the Living Forward book by Michael and Daniel, and that's at the beginning of the week, sort of planning out your ideal week. And again, much like a budget, spending your time on paper first, and it's more than just a calendar and a list of to-dos, but spending your time on paper before, you know, things begin to come up and steal that time. And so for me, I use a couple of resources, and some of them may sound antiquated, but they work best for me because they involve physically writing things down. And I find that for me, that's the best way for me to do it. And so I've got a day timer that I use. Mm-hmm. I recently invested in a productivity planner that I use in conjunction with my day timer. And the productivity planner is just that. It's only about productivity. It's not my entire schedule, but I look at a day like today, and there are a total of 5 tasks, and that's the maximum you get in a day. 5 tasks. You start with the most important task of the day, and there's just one, and you list that first. And then you have a chance to list a couple of secondary tasks, just 2. And then if there's time in the day and you've done those other 3 things already, then there's a chance to list a couple of other tasks. And it's tied to the Pomodoro technique, you know, keeping track of the focus time, 25 minutes at a time, 5-minute breaks, that sort of thing. And as I use this, again, it's all about intentionality and consistency and being very focused with the time that you're working on these most important things, and making sure they come first, and then the other activities of the day, checking email or whatever that might be, come after these things are accomplished.
And what is this productivity thing? Is it an app or what is?
Oh, no, it's a physical book. It's the Productivity Planner, created by Intelligent Change, and it's available on Amazon. Just search Intelligent Change or Productivity Planner. One of the things I like about it is
Jeff and I are paid $100,000 for every
Yeah, we wish. The first 30-some-odd pages, which are important that you read, tell you exactly how to use it. You've got to read that and follow the recommendations there. I have found it extremely useful. Again, I use that in conjunction with a day planner. But I'll start on a Sunday afternoon or a Sunday evening, Laura, and I'll look at, you know, commitments that I have, clients and things like that. and begin mapping out the other things that I personally want to accomplish in addition to those client meetings or interviews like this one. And I will carve out in my digital calendar, where my clients and others are asking of my time, carve out the time for these things I want to accomplish on that digital calendar, so that as the week progresses, I have specified specific days and specific times where I'm going to work on those things most important to me, rather than, you know, starting a day and going, oh, well, I've got, you know, 5 coaching calls. I'm not going to be able to get to any of the stuff that are most important to me. I'm just going to have to focus on the coaching calls. Nothing wrong with batching some of that stuff. But if you're going to batch it, you know, plan that in advance. Don't just allow that to happen by accident. Then make it so.
Yeah.
You know, and carve out that time.
Jeff, could not agree with you more. Out of absolute desperation in the middle of my career, where, you know, anxiety was becoming the name of the day for me with all of the competing tasks and priorities of a growing company, I started developing a system, and I teach it now to my clients, but it literally sounds identical to this. It works so well. It really, like, you know, setting my goals every week, batching out time, planning it ahead of time, because we're organized in a way that we will keep away from things we perceive to be painful and difficult. So those things that are high priorities but difficult, we won't get done unless we're very intentional. And then we'll also just let our time disappear to kind of the squeaky wheel, right? It just
exactly
slips away. Yeah.
I showed this ideal week template that comes out of the Living Forward philosophy to a friend one time. And their comment was, as they looked at it and saw that, you know, pretty much every hour of the day was accounted for, they were like, well, I don't want to be that busy. And I'm like, well, you're missing the point. These hours are going to come and go either way. You need to determine what you're going to do with them. This is not about being busy. This is about deciding in advance what's going to happen at these times on these days and being intentional about it.
Absolutely. The consciousness, the conscious awareness, right? And I think we're all, I don't know, right? You could almost gag just a little bit hearing the word conscious one more time in your life, or mindfulness. But like, the reality is that you said, you know, life is moving forward, time is moving forward. You are either, your thoughts are happening, you're either mastering it and taking control of it, or it will just take control of you, because it is happening whether you're paying attention or not. So I totally agree with you. If you were going to have a week, like, you either take the time to make it happen a certain way, or it'll just happen, right?
And, exactly.
And then I think your point earlier about how to say yes and how to say no, learning to say no and figuring out what that means and when to do it is so critical. So Jeff, now you're consulting with podcasting, you're helping people launch and grow and monetize their shows. And is there any latest, greatest new thing that you've got going on? Or it sounds like enough to me, but
actually, for the first time, I started just a few weeks ago. Literally, I had decided, you know what? I've got this community I've built over at Read to Lead. I've never created any products or services for this crew. I do this podcast coaching and mentoring over here, but that's not related to my podcast or my listeners of that podcast in any way. And I began thinking about what I could do for them, and that resulted in a book club. I thought, what better than a book club where those in the club meet once a month. We decide on a book at the beginning of the month. We read through that during the month. We have a private Facebook group where we can talk about what we're learning along the way. But then we come together virtually, Laura, at the end of the month, and face-to-face virtually talk about what we're reading, what we're going to implement, how we're going to act on what we're reading. Because that, I find, is a real bone of contention for a lot of folks like me who love to read, but then we don't do anything with the information. Mm-hmm. So it's about bridging that gap between intention and implementation, I guess you would say, of actually taking what we're learning and doing something with that knowledge. So that's sort of the...
Ooh, I love that.
That's the backbone behind, we call it Read to Lead University, at readtoleaduniversity.com. We've got just right now 50 charter members. We only allowed 50 people in, and they're helping sort of give feedback and help guide and direct the future of the group. Eventually, we'll let more people in and open up registration a couple of times a year. But if that sounds like something of interest to you, then all you need to do is go to readtoleaduniversity.com, and there's a place where you can pop in your name and email address if you want to be notified the next time registration opens. One of the cool parts about it that people really seem to be drawn to, and when you hear this, it'll make perfect sense, but oftentimes, not every time, but oftentimes those monthly meetings where we get together and talk about the book includes the author, him or herself, with us. And so folks really seem to enjoy that aspect of it.
I love that. And right now, registration, I'm on your site just checking it out. It's closed, but you're going to open it up again soon?
Yeah, the next wave is going to be, let's see, probably the end of March 2017. And then it'll probably be another 6 months after that before we open registration again. So I'm not sure when this is being published, but it'll probably be before then. So if you're hearing this and it's not yet the end of March 2017, you have time to get in real soon.
Fantastic. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on, for sharing your story, giving us insights into the world of radio and podcasting. It's just also just really fun to catch up with you.
Likewise. And again, I appreciate the chance to come on to talk about Read to Lead University and Read to Lead and radio and all that good stuff. I appreciate the chance always to do this. And you're a fantastic host, regardless of who your coach was.
And anybody out there who's looking for information on Jeff, you can come over to our site, lauraco.com/podcast, and you will find all the links to everything that we discussed on today's episode. Thanks again, Jeff.
Thank you.